Welcome to the program. For those of us that grew up in and around big cities, the idea of small-town America is often alien and perplexing. Yet if we scratch beneath the surface, there is a poignancy in looking at places still untouched by the ethos of popular culture. Such a place is Utopia, Texas, a town 90 miles west of San Antonio. It has no movie theater, bookstore, music store, and only recently did it get internet and cable television. My guest, Entertainment Weekly senior writer Karen Valby, in her new book, Welcome to Utopia, takes us deep inside this place of cowboys and farmers and shows what happens when the old tensions of small-town life confront a new reality of creative destruction. It is my pleasure to welcome Karen Valby to the program to talk about Welcome to Utopia, Notes from a Small Town. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did you discover the town of Utopia?
Well, like you said, I'm a writer for Entertainment Weekly, and my editor came into my office one day, and he thought it would be interesting if I would go off looking for a small town in America that didn't have access to mainstream entertainment. I went to college in San Antonio, Texas, so I emailed my alumni list and said, this is what I'm looking for, and I'm a product of suburbs and cities, so can somebody help me out? Did somebody grow up in a town like this? And a friend wrote back and said, oh, I grew up in just a town, and when I was in high school, there were no movie theaters and no music or bookstores, and we only got two stations on our television, and there was one AM radio station, and the only pop culture was this shelf of outdated videotapes down at the town's one gas station. And the name of my town growing up is Utopia, and it just felt like such a gift. And off I went to get my driver's license, and then I headed down to Utopia.
And what did you find when you got there?
Well, Utopia, it's funny when I meet people who say they grew up in small towns, and they're like, yeah, there was only a few thousand people and two stoplights. It's like, oh, that's the big city compared to Utopia. Utopia is about a half-mile stretch of Main Street, and a few hundred people live there, and there's one school in town that's kind of the hub of the community, and in all 13 grades, there's about 190 kids. And it's sort of like going back in time because people still visit, and you know, if there's ever somebody in trouble, like, everybody comes right away to rally around them bearing casseroles, and people leave their keys in their trucks and nobody locks their doors. And at the same time, there's 20 kids that have graduated from the school who are in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they now have satellite TV, so probably per capita just as many people are watching American Idol or Dancing with the Stars as they are in New York.
And how does a town like this differ from, you know, going to Pennsylvania and visiting, you know, Amish country?
You know, I don't know if it is that different, and that's been a curious thing now that the book is out. Is wherever I go, be it in Washington State or Maine or, you know, Maryland, people say, oh, that's just what life was like in my small town. Like, all the old-timers gathered in the morning to drink coffee at the welding shop or the ice station, and Utopia, it's at the back of the general store, and, you know, all the kids were kind of raised by everybody, and if anybody caught them speeding, like, their parents were sure to find out, and it was kind of like, you know, the town raises up a kid. And there's also the same idiosyncrasies and issues that people in a small town face, and those are dark ones, too. Not everything about living in a small town is something to be revered and aspired to. So I think small town life, be it in Texas or anywhere else in America, is kind of, there's a similar flavor going on there.
Is that part of the problem, that we have this kind of utopian, if you will, idea of what small towns should be like based on some 1950s television fantasy?
Well, that is so true. And, you know, it's funny, in pop culture, small towns are always either revered and, like, kind of placed in, like, a snow globe of, like, happy, like, smiling, red-cheeked faces and the fences and pastoral scenes, or, like, in, like, Bruce Springsteen songs or movies, like, small towns are, like, really dark places that anybody with imagination and brains need to escape from. And so I guess the purpose of going to Utopia to really live there for a while and to learn about the people was to see see a small town clearly and not as this fantasy, idyllic world that America should return to if we had any sense, or some cesspool from which, you know, we must escape. There's as much garbage and goodness going on in small towns as there are in cities. It's just a little different.
Before modernity came to this town, mm-hmm. was there a sense of being disconnected from the rest of the world, and did the townspeople see that in a positive light?
I really think so. I mean, it's funny. I was talking with a woman down at the antique shop, and she said that when she was growing up, like, if they didn't hear about it on the town's 1 a.m. station, they just didn't know it existed in the world. And these old-timers I would drink coffee with, they didn't see television when they couldn't afford a TV, even if it wasn't invented yet. And so there just wasn't... there wasn't a concern or an interest, let alone a desire, to see the rest of the world. And life was utopia. The world was utopia. It was the center of their universe and their only universe. And now, you know, they've only really had a decade to wrestle with this view, this real upfront view of the rest of the world. So now kids there just have a much different idea of what their futures might look like or what their dreams can look like, and that's confusing for a small town.
And of course, once the kids see the rest of the world, most of them, I'm sure, want to escape and don't want to come back.
Oh yeah, and there's also, I mean, you know, there's not an industry in utopia. I mean, these are people that used to make a living ranching. They would eat the food they grew. They would sustain their families by the power and productivity of their land, and now ranching just isn't really a viable industry. So this town that used to pride itself on being disconnected is finding that it has, in order to survive, it has to become more in, it's now focusing on the recreational side of things. So that involves tourists and newcomers and outside money, and so it's just a very confusing time for utopia as they try to survive and reshift their identity. And it's also sort of becoming a retirement community where people that live their whole lives in the city decide, like, oh, I want a beautiful view, and I want to pretend I'm a rancher. So now, you know, the old people way outnumber the young people in utopia, as they do in the majority of small towns across America.
And how did the old-timers feel about this?
Well, I mean, as you probably can guess, old-timers, particularly small-town old-timers, really resist change and see it as a threat to their sense of history and their sense of traditions and rituals, and their very comfort zone feels threatened. So, you know, even something as benign sounding as, you know, the government wanting to pay to put sidewalks up and down Main Street was really seen as a threat to a way of life. And at the town meeting where they discussed the possibility of sidewalks, like, the conversation got so heated that it looked like a fellow was going to, like, bust out a shotgun at one point. You wouldn't think sidewalks would provoke this type of reaction, but I guess maybe the surprise for me was that I went down there thinking, like, I'm going to really root for the kids who want to get out, and I'm going to more see myself in the young people who are agitating for some change in their lives. And lo and behold, it was kind of these old-timers that were these, particularly these coffee drinkers I met with every morning, these stoic, kind of stubborn, gruff men. I really felt for them, and I found myself having enormous affection for them, and there was something very wistful and vulnerable about their fear of change. And along with that fear of change is kind of a reflexive suspicion of anyone that doesn't look or sound or dream like them, and that's very hard to bear witness to as well. But they were good men, and their town was changing, and thus their world was changing, and it was hard not to feel wistful along with them.
And were they angry?
Angry about change?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, they were. I was also there. I spent about 2 years in Utopia, and I left not long after Barack Obama was elected the president.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this was kind of a Republican hotbed. It's not a Tea Party type of town. That would be too overwrought for Utopians. They're stoic. I would hear foul language about people that did not look like them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was ugly, ugly and foul language. And, you know, it's worth noting that on one day when a conversation got particularly ugly, Ralph, who was sort of the head of the old timers, and he ran the general store for 40 years, he followed me the next morning up the refrigerated foods aisle and wanted to make sure I knew that despite his shameful, ugly language, that he knew that you judge a man by his actions and not the color of his skin. And suddenly he found himself in tears. And I don't think this means Ralph is any more open-minded of or evolved of an individual when it comes to race relations in America, but he does have a sense of shame. And it was sort of this very touching, tender moment. That said, I think all these guys were, and they deny that it was because Barack is a black man, but they were stunned that all of a sudden their country is, that a black man is at the helm. And it's just, that's not the vision of the world they grew up with. So, and yet at the same time, their children and their grandchildren are bringing home Hispanic or black men, to introduce.
Mm-hmm.
So they're being forced to change and to evolve, and that's a wonderful thing. We always need to be able somewhere in ourselves to grow, but it's for anybody it's uncomfortable, and for these old timers, man, it really was uncomfortable.
How did you get them to trust you?
Well, you know, it was interesting because first I wrote this magazine article for EW that mainly focused on a few kids in town, like the one black girl at the school, this 22-year-old misfit who, like, you know, wears mousse in his hair and wears, pink suspenders to the cafe, which there is, like, I mean, really making a statement. So I wrote about these kids that were kind of clinging on to this sudden access to pop culture and hoping it would kind of ride them out of their small town. So when I went back to write the book, people were a little suspicious, and they didn't understand why I had focused on, like, this punk kid as opposed to the fiddle player at the Methodist church. So it took a couple months of just hanging around and giving in to the fact that whenever I went to the cafe, I was going to hear myself talked about from every surrounding table, and I just had to accept that. Like, I was the outsider in this town, and, you know, it was time to have thick skin. And I think just hanging around and expressing that I had genuine interest in them, and not just the kids, but the parents and the old-timers alike, and wearing my ignorance about what it means to live in a small town, honestly, I think after a while people kind of just gave in and believed that I wanted to hear their stories as well.
Tell us a little bit about some of the characters that you mentioned, Ralph being one of them.
Yes. Well, I wanted to not just write about one experience in town or one archetypal experience in town. So while I did write about this, as I said, the one black girl at the school, when I met her, she was 16 and, you know, dreaming really big, big dreams of being a rock star in the city one day, and yet there was nobody in this town that could teach her how to play the guitar, and her name was Kelly, and I followed her for 2 years, and then there was Coulter, and he was the 22-year-old misfit who, you know, tells everybody he's going to be this famous video game designer in Tokyo or Los Angeles one day, and in the meantime is expected to inherit the family ranch and is working road construction for $8.90 an hour. And then there's Kathy. She is a middle-aged mother of four boys, but when I met her, her oldest son had been killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan, and she had two more boys who were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then, as I mentioned, there is Ralph, and he's kind of the quintessential old-timer who, you know, is so wedded to ritual and routine and wakes up every morning at 5 and leaves the house every morning at 5:11 to get down to the general store to take the throne at the head of this horseshoe of old-timers who meet every day to talk about life in Utopia. And they kind of form the Greek chorus of the book. But I just kind of wanted to hit every experience and talk not just about why kids sometimes feel the burning need to run from their small town, but also why people choose to stay in their small town and why that's the only natural decision for some people. And I wanted to make sure to honor that choice as well.
As someone who had been writing, who was making a living writing about popular culture,
mm-hmm.
talk about how you changed your views, if at all, about popular culture when you saw a place like this that was somehow insulated from it.
Right. Well, I like to think I always understood pop culture's place, that I didn't presume that just because magazines that are published in Los Angeles and New York think it's the most important thing in the world when Tom Cruise has a baby, I like to think that I know it's more important or, you know, equally as important when my neighbor has a baby who's premature and is in the hospital for a few days. I like to think that I know pop culture's place, that it can be, you know, a distraction and a reflection and an inspiration, but that it's not necessarily reality by any means. But that said, it was just tremendously important for me to go down to a town where not only is pop culture not the end-all, be-all, but it's like 25th, 30th, 35th in line under weather, neighbor's health, church, community obligations, family obligations. It is just relegated to the way back seat and to its rightful place. And that said, you know, I watch an episode of Glee with these kids where one of the characters scolds another for calling him a fag, and why that is a hateful term and a damaging term and a destructive term. And I can't help but think, God, I love that these high school kids in Utopia, Texas are hearing this from characters they empathize with and root for. I can't help but think, yes, pop culture is silly often and it's stupid often, but it can also at its best be very affirming and beautiful. So they're taking the good with the bad just like the rest of us.
But of course the old timers see it very differently.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, none of those coffee drinkers are watching Glee, that's for sure. But and you know, we choose the vision on TV that we want to encourage. So yeah, all of these old timers are you know, they're watching Fox News while I might be watching PBS or whatever. But, you know, you could say that access to pop culture just gives these old-timers more to complain about. Mm. You know, and also, gosh, having that type of access to the world is very painful as well. Kathy, who is the mother of the boys in the Army, her son's death was first broadcast on the crawl of Fox News, and that's where her husband first saw the news. They didn't know Jeff was a part of those 11 soldiers killed in a crash, but that's quite different from Kelly's grandfather, who served in World War II and his plane was shot down and spent 3 months in a prison camp in Germany, and his young bride at home had no idea for months whether her groom was alive or dead. I mean, the immediacy with which we are connected to the world is can be terribly frightening.
What do you think happens to a town like this over the next 10 years?
You know, I have to say that I just think the moments that I caught, the stories that I heard while I was there, I'm so glad to have now written down in a book, because to me it feels like a record. And like some of the institutions that I write about, like the lumberyard, for instance, the lumberyard is a bit closed since I finish the book. And this is a this is like one of the huge landmarks in town that has been passed down from generation to generation, and it just no longer was making any money, and it closed doors. And I just find now, having known Utopia and known like the culture that went on at the lumberyard, the idea that it no longer exists is so sad to me. And you know, I think it's great that Utopia is sustaining itself with new money and the fresh blood from all these newcomers, but these are people that were, you know, made millions in their careers in Houston and San Antonio and California even, and they don't know the history of Utopia, and they have different ideas of where the town should go. So, you know, as this generation of old-timers dies off, I don't think anybody's going to replace them at the back of the general store. I mean, I think that bench where these cowboys drink coffee will go unused in the future, if there even is a general store. I mean, now most people drive the hour or the hour and a half to go get cheaper supplies at Walmart or the HEB at the, you know, an hour and a half away, and it's a miracle that the general store even still exists. It's just not the culture of our country anymore. I think Utopia will always be there in some form, but certainly not the way it is now. And that's not all bad. You know, the kids that are in school now are reading more and seeing more and wanting more than their parents and grandparents, and that's great. But it's also something to mourn a little bit.
Karen Valby, her book is Welcome to Utopia, Notes from a Small Town. Karen, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.